Staff Sergeant Earl D. Plumley's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty are keeping with the finest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, the Special Forces Regiment, and the United States Army. Signed, Joseph R. Biden, the President of the United States.
I just got lucky, I guess.
Our troops started taking rocket fire, recoilless rifle fire, and small arms fire. While the driver of their truck maneuvered into the line of enemy fire to shield injured members of their team outside the vehicle, the staff sergeant exited the vehicle and used his own body to shield the driver. He left whatever cover the truck provided him and began to engage the invaders. Outnumbered with no regard for his own safety, at times armed with only a pistol, Staff Sergeant Plumley attacked the insurgent forces, taking them on one by one. And time and again, bullets flew by, sometimes only inches away. And time and again, Staff Sergeant Plumley closed with the enemy. And multiple occasions during the fight, the insurgents detonated their vests right in front of Plumley, at one point hurling him into a wall and injuring his back.
At some point, he saw a wounded American soldier, Staff Sergeant Hollis, and he went over, put two tourniquets on him, took him over, and got him exfilled.
Well, I knew if we didn't eliminate them as rapidly as possible, it was going to be a mess if they started running all the way through the camp. And what we understand about their plan, it would have been a nightmare scenario.
At a critical moment when they were engaging the insurgents, one of them ran into an empty bunker near the airfield and he detonated his vest, which clearly demonstrated what their intent was. So Earl and the other brave special operators that day were able to not only stop them short of that catastrophic turn, but also neutralize that threat. And I think that all of those guys deserve definitely accolades. But above all, Earl has epitomized that which we all strive to be.
Thanks for tuning in to SOCOM Athletes Podcast, Send Me. This is your host, Jason, and today I am humbled to bring you our guest for this episode, Master Sergeant Earl Plumley, who was awarded the Medal of Honor. The Medal of Honor is the United States Armed Forces' highest military decoration and is awarded to recognize American warriors for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of their own life above and beyond the call of duty. So get ready for another exhilarating episode of SOCOM Athletes Podcast, Send Me. But first, some exciting announcements from our SOCOM athlete community. I received two text messages last week from two individuals that successfully completed Special Forces Assessment and Selection Class 0324 and were selected as 18 Delta and 18 Charlie. They will advance on into the Special Forces Qualification Course to learn the skills and traits that they need for the Green Beret. Next, I'm honored to announce that we had a student graduate the MSRT pipeline last month. The MSRT pipeline is the most elite of the Coast Guard. They are the Coast Guard's elite special operations unit, focusing on visit board search and seizure operations, counterterrorism, and hostage rescue. They are some bad, bad dudes. Congratulations to our man for never quitting and graduating the MSRT pipeline. A fun fact about him, when he came to our Destin Hell Day 2 years ago, he swam a 13:04 on the 500-yard swim. I almost made him stop and pulled him out of the water so that we could keep the event going. Before going into the MSRT pipeline, he improved his 500-yard swim time to an 8:43. He did that with hard work, commitment, and dedication. And if he can do it, you can do it. Congratulations to our stud. Next, I had the honor of attending PJ Class 2303 recently to see not one but two of our SOCOM athlete studs earn the coveted Maroon Beret and officially blouse their boots and become United States Air Force pararescuemen. The PJ pipeline is known by many to be the most challenging pipeline in the Department of Defense. In order to become a PJ, you must first get through ANS, Combat Dive School, Airborne, SEER, HALO, Mountaineering, EMT Basic, EMT Paramedic, followed by a six-month pararescue apprentice course that involves fast roping, rappelling, climbing rope ladders, and jumping out of helicopters on land and into the water. Air operations such as halo and static line jumps on land and into the water, advanced ropes and mountaineering, small unit tactics, land navigation, and of course, dirt medicine and advanced medicine. Congratulations to our studs for never quitting and making it through. One of these individuals was unsuccessful at the PJ indoctrination course over 5 years ago. He spent 5 years in the Air Force doing a job that he didn't want to do, but kept a great attitude and never quit on his goals. And now he is a United States Air Force pararescueman. Congratulations to you too. Next, we had a student graduate combat control school recently to earn his Scarlet Beret. He is now officially a combat controller, which is a near 3-year pipeline in which these individuals go through combat dive school, halo school, air traffic control school, advanced tactics, land navigation, close quarter battle, and more. Combat controllers are some bad, bad dudes. Congratulations to our stud for graduating combat control school class 2303. And lastly, congratulations to our former SOCOM athlete student that recently became a Navy SEAL. Earning his Trident after graduating SQT, that's the SEAL qualification course, we have another former SOCOM athlete student that is going to be graduating in this next SEAL qualification training class coming up in the beginning of March. I am absolutely honored to announce that our students are making it through the pipeline, coming through this program as one of the pieces of the puzzle to equip them for success before going into selection. For those of you listening to this podcast that have worked with me personally, come out to our courses, done our workout prep programs, please keep in touch with me. Let me know how you're doing throughout the pipeline. I would be honored to come to your graduation and represent for you and support you on your big day. There is no greater honor for myself and this program to have you come through here before going into your pipeline and then seeing you accomplish your dreams and your goals and get into the special operations community. Next, I am pumped to announce that Army National Guard Special Forces is partnering up with myself and SOCOM Athlete to run a new event that is free to attend, the Special Forces Challenge. The Special Forces Challenge is a 12-hour event that is open to civilians ages 16+, military members, and ROTC cadets that want to see if they have what it takes for a career in Special Forces. This event includes an official fitness test, mentorship and Q&A with Green Berets that are doing the job right now, a ruck march, exciting and challenging team exercises that you'll see in Special Forces assessment and selection, and the most exciting part is that select individuals that the Green Berets feel have what it takes after completion of the SFC will be offered an 18 X-ray contract. Now, you'll still have to go through MEPS, take your ASVAB, and go through the same screening process that all recruiters require. However, this is your opportunity to see if you have what it takes and essentially try out and earn an 18 X-ray contract on the spot. There has never been any other event like this, and we are excited to spearhead this endeavor as we dive into the future of Special Operations recruiting. Event dates and event registration will be published soon on the SOCOM Athlete website and announced on our social media channels. So stay tuned and get ready for the Special Forces Challenge. Now, without further delay, let's get to today's guest, Master Sergeant Earl Plumley, a former Recon Marine who became a Green Beret and was awarded the nation's highest honor, the Medal of Honor. His Medal of Honor citation reads as follows. Staff Sergeant Earl D. Plumley distinguished himself by acts of gallantry above and beyond the call of duty on August 28, 2013, while serving as a Weapons Sergeant C Company 4th Battalion 1st Special Forces Group in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. Sergeant Plumley instantly responded to an enemy attack on Ford Operating Base Ghazni, Ghazni Province, Afghanistan, that began with an explosion that tore a 60-foot breach in the base's perimeter wall. 10 insurgents wearing Afghan National Army uniforms and suicide vests poured through the breach. Sergeant Plumley and 5 others mounted 2 vehicles and raced towards the explosion. When his vehicle was engaged by enemy fire, Sergeant Plumley reacted instinctively, using his body to shield the driver prior to exiting the vehicle and engaging enemy insurgents 15 meters away to the vehicle's right with his pistol. Without cover and in complete disregard for his own safety, he advanced on the enemy, engaging multiple insurgents with only his pistol. Upon reaching cover, he killed 2 insurgents, one with a grenade and the other by detonating the insurgent's suicide vest using precision sniper fire from only 20 meters away. Again, disregarding his own personal safety, Sergeant Plumlee advanced alone against the enemy, engaging several insurgents at close range, including one whose suicide vest exploded a mere 7 meters away from his position. Under intense enemy fire, Sergeant Plumlee temporarily withdrew to cover, where he joined up with another soldier and together they mounted another counterattack. Under fierce enemy fire, Sergeant Plumlee again moved from cover and attacked the enemy forces, advancing within 7 meters of a previously wounded insurgent who detonated his suicide vest, blowing Sergeant Plumlee back against a nearby wall. Sergeant Plumlee, ignoring his injuries, quickly regained his faculties and re-engaged the enemy forces. Intense enemy fire once again forced the two soldiers to temporarily withdraw. Undeterred, Sergeant Plumlee joined a small group of American and Polish soldiers who moved from cover to once again counterattack the infiltrators. As the force advanced, Sergeant Plumlee engaged an insurgent to his front left. He then swung around and engaged another insurgent who charged the group from the rear. The insurgents detonated his suicide vest, mortally wounding a U.S. soldier. Sergeant Plumlee, again with complete disregard for his own safety, ran to the wounded soldier, carried him to safety, and rendered first aid. He then methodically cleared the area, remained in a security posture, and continued to scan for any remaining threats. Staff Sergeant Earl D. Plumlee's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty are in keeping with the finest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, the Special Forces Regiment, and the United States Army. The Medal of Honor was awarded to Master Sergeant Earl Plumlee on December 16th, 2021, by the President of the United States. And it's with great humility that we welcome today's guest, Medal of Honor recipient Earl Plumlee. Thanks for coming on the show, brother. How are you doing today, my man?
I'm doing great, man. I'm up in the Pacific Northwest, and we're trudging through a wet winter. But other than that, we're doing great. Even though I retired, I'm still living in the same house that I was in, and we're just out off post from a Joint Base Lewis-McChord up here near Tacoma.
And Earl, you just retired recently. Is that correct? How long have you been out, man?
January 18th was my last day as officially as a soldier.
So it's only been like a couple weeks.
You know, I came off of the team and quit being operational probably almost 2 years ago. So it's kind of been for me, it was, you know, not that big of a change, because that was the real gut punch for me was when I, you know, was never, even though I was still in uniform, I was never going to deploy again and never be a part of that. So it was kind of like a slow tiered walk out the back door of the Army.
And Earl, you have an absolutely incredible story. And for our listeners out there, Earl has been in the Marine Corps. He's been in the Army. He comes from military lineage. And Earl, our listeners are primarily young men that are aspiring to be special operators. Would you mind telling us a little bit about where you were at in life when you were in their shoes? What was the story of young Earl Plumlee?
So, you know, I came from a military family. You know, everybody would always tell those stories around the fireplace. And I just always longed to be a part of that. You know, as a young man, I wanted to sit in that inner circle, earn my spot. And honestly, I didn't have a big plan to work in special operations. It just kind of ended up that way. You know, originally I wanted to be a pilot. I had aspirations to go to the Air Force Academy. And then as I was going through high school, I realized that, like, I hated being inside. And even though a fighter jet is super neat, it's basically an office with fancy knobs in it. You know, I started, you know, I saw Navy SEALs and, you know, saw God up there with the Barrett 50 cal. And I was like, that's kind of rad.
Was it Top Gun that inspired you to be a pilot?
Yeah, Top Gun. I was like, that's the job for me. You know,
it just goes to show you how effective like a movie can be with recruiting. I feel like everyone that wants to be a pilot, they've been like, yeah, I saw Top Gun and wanted to be a pilot.
I mean, it's hilarious with how much popular media like affected my choices and aspirations. So, you know, I wanted to be a Navy SEAL, and I had a really good friend of mine growing up, Cody Vignall. We were going to be Navy SEALs. We couldn't wait to get out of Oklahoma and go be Navy SEALs together. And then, of course, The Rock came out. And I was like, wait a minute. Who are these guys? Force Recon. And they just like wrecked these SEALs, you know, in the opening scene of that. So I started going down this rabbit hole of what a recon Marines were, and started doing a lot of reading with the old breed. That kind of, and my, you know, my dad was originally a Marine, and really the Marine Corps has this super neat trap. If you have a family member that was a Marine and he recommends the Marine Corps to you, you go and join the Marine Corps. And then, like my father, if he tells you not to join the Marine Corps, It's because he doesn't believe that you're tough enough. So you got to go prove him wrong and join the Marine Corps. So
no matter what, you're going into the Marine Corps.
Yeah. And then, you know, my dad's okay. You know, if you're going to join the Marine Corps, whatever you do, don't join the infantry. So, of course, you know, like any good rebellious son, I was like, I'll show you I'm tough enough for the infantry. And went and joined the Marine Corps as an 0351 anti-armor assaultman, which is, you know, I'm old. That MOS doesn't even exist anymore.
What was your childhood like, Earl?
So, I grew up in Western Oklahoma. We had a cattle, I guess I'll use the word operation. We had about 500 acres on our river bottom land. And then we had several other plots that we used to move them around. Western Oklahoma is hard because there's just no water. So you gotta kind of hop from one place to the other to keep your cattle running. I didn't wear shoes or shirt or, you know, half the time pants. I was running around that river bottom country in Western Oklahoma, eating outdoors more often than not. I didn't know you needed a hunting license until much later in life. and then so like that, and that's kind of what led me into choosing the path I did is, you know, going to school used to kill me. My feet would get hot because anytime I wasn't in school, I didn't have shoes on. And so the idea of, you know, being in the Air Force, walking from a building to an aircraft, I was kind of like, is that really what I want to do? Anyway, ended up at the School of Infantry eventually. And I didn't ever go inside. You wish you get too much of what you're looking for sometimes. I don't know. I'm really impressed with these people that go straight into special forces or SOCOM selections, because I know I absolutely was not ready as a young man. I would have failed. There is no special program that would have enjoyed a 18-year-old Earl Plumley.
And a lot of our students and people who come through the SOCOM athlete program have some struggles with the recruitment process, whether it be getting blown off by a recruiter or getting false information or character waiver. How was your recruitment process for you? Was that smooth or did it take you some time to get in? How'd that go?
I'm a pre-war Marine and I wanted an infantry contract. So the recruiter couldn't wait. He was, you know, I made his day because all I wanted was 03XX and the earliest ship date that he had. So that was super easy for me. Now, if I had wanted like the RMAT program, the Recon Marine Awaiting Training program, or any of those pipelines, like, yeah, I see guys waiting, you know, up to 2 years for their slot. And honestly, as a young man, that would have just killed me. You know, I've always been, what's the word, excitable and distractible. So I went into the infantry, honestly, probably saved everybody some time because I still had some growing to do. And, you know, honestly, after coming out of the infantry, a lot of the performance standards for different places I've served were, you know, while they're elite levels, it just wasn't that hard. Being a straight leg Marine Corps infantryman, you might not know all the fancy tricks of CQB and have all the cool schools, but you can cover ground with a ruck on your back. And that's the baseline test for almost every special program I've been to is, hey, you got to walk 18 miles in a set amount of time with a set amount of weight. I was ready to do that.
You know, a lot of our students, not the majority of them, but a lot of our students are kind of in the mindset of perhaps I should go to college before I enlist with the special operations contract so I can develop more maturity and have more time to train. And typically what I tell them is that why would you spend 4 years getting a college degree just to enlist in a special operations career field when you could just do a conventional job in the military, gain that maturity, get that baseline as a warrior, and then cross train over into special operations selection, then get the post 9/11 GI Bill after you've kind of figured out who you are, then go to college later. What are your thoughts on that, man?
It depends on what their path is. I know if you're going to be a Green Beret, you know, the Q course, you get a degree, you get an associate's after you graduate. And you have a built into your career path inside the regiment. You got a couple holes to punch and you'll end up with a bachelor's. I'm an anomaly as an E8. I think I'm one of three E8s when I got selected that didn't have a master's degree. Not that you're wasting your time with that education, but I'd be very cautious picking any old degree. If you're getting a technical degree, I know that like cyber warfare, cyber defense, if you're going to get degrees that translate into the job that you're going to have, then by all means get after it. But if you're just looking for a piece of paper that says that you can show up in the right time in the right place, I would discourage somebody from doing that, especially if they're paying out of pocket. If you're paying your own money for that, it's not really going to further your career in the Army per se.
Absolutely. So you're brand new, you're in the Marine Corps, you finished boot camp. I mean, how was Marine Corps boot camp for you?
I think I gained 38 pounds in boot camp.
38 pounds.
Yeah. It's amazing if you are forced to sleep 8 hours and eat three meals a day instead of running all over the place, chasing women and getting in trouble, your body really will reset to a really healthy look. But yeah, I gained my football coach when I came back from Marine Corps boot camp was just shattered because he'd been just doing everything and anything to get me to gain weight. And so he was like, what did they do to you? I was like, well, they tucked me in at night and they would not let me get out of bed until the morning. But no, I didn't find boot camp that challenging. It was actually, I really was mostly entertaining because, you know, you're just watching people just kind of lose their mind. And for whatever reason, if that pressure, the first time you're under pressure, you lose about half your intelligence. Watching guys get yelled at for the first time and they can't do a simple task, like put a sock on their left foot instead of their right foot because they're just getting shattered. I thought it was hilarious the entire time. Which I got in incredible shape because you're not allowed to giggle and laugh in boot camp. So I you know, in Marine Corps boot camp, we call it the quarter deck. And I was constantly up there for lack of discipline and military bearing because, you know, you see some guy just run around like he's on fire because he can't put the right sock on. To me, it was fun. So I had a lot of fun in boot camp. I didn't really feel different until I got to the School of Infantry. You know, in boot camp, I learned how to wear a uniform and, you know, technically I was a Marine, but I didn't really feel changed and different until after the School of Infantry, because then I kind of mastered the arms and really became an actual combatant. You know, I became somebody that would be lethal on the battlefield, as lethal as a private with 3 months of training can be. But I was, you know, I knew how to feel a job on the battlefield. And for me, the School of Infantry was kind of the turning point where I was like, this is real. I'm not who I was when I left my hometown.
Earl, how do you feel that your upbringing in Oklahoma and walking around barefoot and getting in scraps and being outside all the time, how do you think that prepared you for your new career in the Marine Corps versus maybe other guys that grew up in the city or were working a desk job or whatever it may be?
I was ready to be in the infantry. It wasn't that big a leap for me. And every time I go back and talk to people about recruiting, and you know, if you're working a ranch out here in Oklahoma or Texas, when they say that the military is like this arduous journey, they're talking to the kid from LA. They're not talking to you. This is actually easier than what you're doing. So if that's what's holding you up, you know, don't wait anymore. It's super easy compared to running a ranch or working in the oil field. But yeah, it definitely prepared me. The first time, not in the School of Infantry because it's in California, but when I got to Hawaii. And it like rained on us. We were walking all day in the rain. And then we went and dug a hole and it rained all night. And everybody's like, are we going to, you know, what are we going to do? We're all wet. And I was like, yeah, we'll walk around tomorrow and get dry. For people that was their first time, it was an emotional event to like just be uncomfortable and to you know, be out of that envelope. Because the United States is a pretty soft country on the face of it. And usually you get wet. That's game over. You go home. You throw those clothes in the laundry and you put on clean clothes. So, you know, most Americans have never really been wet for like days at a time. And even me, you know, even growing up on a ranch, I was never wet for more than, you know, a day. I definitely didn't like, you know, wear wet clothes for a week. You know, that was just actually becoming that, you know, what I was looking for. I wanted to be outside, you know, learning how to live out of a ruck and not in a different level of clean, you know. You know, staying hygienic, but by no metric of anyone's imagination was I clean. And if you've never smelled an infantry battalion come out of the field, you're missing out on a really neat experience.
And this is at SOI West out in Camp Pendleton?
Yeah. And then, you know, Hawaii. Hawaii was my first duty station. So I went to 3rd Marines out of Kaneohe Bay. And, you know, you think Hawaii, you think tropical paradise. Well, you know, up in the mountains of Hawaii, you can find some adversity.
How was it over there, man? That big change from Oklahoma.
I loved Hawaii. I love the food. I love the people. Getting punched in the face doesn't necessarily hurt my feelings. I got a ton of friends from Hawaii. We got along really well. I loved my whole time in the infantry. I did outgrow it. That's one of the reasons I left. We did PT every morning, come back, shower, clean your room, and then we'd have some form of a training, you know, whether it be going to the range or just getting classes on what you don't know. I want to say we spent at least every other week out in the Kahukus, which is a training area in Hawaii, you know, living under a rock, land nabbing through the jungle. We were still fighting Cold War. So we would hike all over the place and dig in these big company level or battalion level defensive positions in the mountains out there. And it was great. I think I complained about a lot of stuff like privates do, but you know, maybe on a day I was bored, but never more than a couple hours at a time would I be bored, because we were always getting after something. And then when I wasn't at work, you know, I was in Hawaii trying to get killed in the ocean or get killed in the mountains. So always having some kind of adventure.
Were you surfing? What were you doing out in the ocean?
Yeah, I tried to surf, and Hawaii is a rough place to learn if you're not on the tourist side of the island. You know, the North Shore break, and then the northern side of the Marine Corps base has got some pretty gnarly waves. You know, God takes care of drunks and fools. I'm dual qualified. But yeah, I don't know why I didn't die out there learning how to surf. I think the first wave I ever really got on was like a double overhead. And I came off of it, probably punched with the board about 30 feet underwater. You know, just having my Hawaiian adventure. Anything I didn't know how to do, I'd go after it aggressively. And spearfishing ended up being my thing that I really liked.
For our listeners out there, when Earl says double overhead, we're talking a 10 to 12 foot wave. And the North Shore is where the Banzai pipeline is. And that's where more surfers have been injured than any other surf spot known in the whole world. So this place is no joke.
Yeah, I got my my buddy Roger Kalkoven really trying to show me the ropes on how to surf. And he is a epic surfer. He's been in Hawaii his whole life. So you know, he took me out. These are going to be really great waves to learn on. And I was just getting pummeled.
Yeah, being out in the ocean with surf like that is one of the most humbling experiences that you could ever have. And for our listeners out there, if you guys are pursuing a career like being a reconnaissance Marine or a Navy SEAL or a PJ, get out there in the ocean when the surf is high and get some experience. Of course, bring a swimming buddy or two with you and make sure that you can swim well, but get out there in the open water. Don't just consolidate yourself to a pool.
And that was I learned to swim really in the Marine Corps. I had some basic ability. But you know, Oklahoma is not famous for its aquatic adventures.
Couple ponds.
Yeah, you know, the North Fork of the Red River, which is where I grew up. It's ankle deep most of the year. Which is funny that I became such a an avid swimmer. I volunteered and successfully trained as a MQIS, which is a Marine Corps water survival instructor, and ended up being a combatant diver when I became a Force Recon Marine. So Western Oklahoma, which has been described as a desert by some people, being a Marine is like living in the water most of the time.
So Earl, you retired as a Green Beret, and that's probably what most of our listeners, when they think about you or they've seen your image or read your citation, that's what they refer to you as. But you were a reconnaissance Marine. So can we rewind a minute? And would you mind telling us how you ended up being in Hawaii as an infantryman to becoming a recon Marine?
So when I joined the Marine Corps, they have a wish list, and I picked overseas duty station because I didn't know anything. I just knew I want to be out. I want to see stuff. The only place you can be stationed overseas is an infantry Marine is Hawaii. So the Marine Corps was like, fine, you're going to be stationed in Hawaii. You know, I'd always had this kind of dream to be a recon Marine. You know, the only way to do that at this time was you would serve somewhere in the Marine Corps, and then you could volunteer for it, which is why, you know, I went to the infantry with the end goal of being a recon Marine. Probably would end up being a recon Marine sooner, but, you know, 9/11 happened and slowed me down for a couple of years. But, you know, so while I was in the infantry, I went to, we called it NDOC, but it's a selection to make sure that you're trainable and usable. And then I got a RIP slot, which is a recon indoctrination platoon, and you learn all the skills necessary to graduate with the schools. Now there's only one now. When I went, there was two, one East Coast and West Coast, but they just make sure that you have the basic skills and physical fitness to actually compete in the school.
In the recon indoctrination platoon, is it fair to say that has evolved into what now is called the Reconnaissance Training and Assessment Program, RTAP, formerly known as Basic Reconnaissance Prep Course?
Yeah, and I was just out there, and it is what a phenomenal program. Their method of engagement on the training and how they look at it. So when I went, it was a hard yes or no. And it was, if you weren't already most of the way there, they threw you away because you weren't worth the investment. Now that this new program, they catch you right after boot camp. They teach you how to get fit. They teach you about nutrition. They teach you how to swim. They teach you how to tie knots. They teach you everything you need to become a recon Marine other than the will to actually take that first step. And it's just, it's an amazing program. Their attrition to injury is just so low. And that was the big, hurdle when I was coming through. You're out there at the ragged edge of what your physical capabilities are. So guys get hurt and then, you know, that the party's over. And so this kind of the crawl, walk, run approach to physical training and then slowly mastering these more difficult skills has really cut down on the injuries. And it's really upped their graduation rate. When I went, you know, they just locked us in a room and whoever was alive at the end of it got to be a recon Marine.
Yeah, to touch back on RTC for our listeners out there, that's the reconnaissance training company out at SOI West in Camp Pendleton. They've opened up their doors to SOCOM Athlete to do our Hell Day events out there over the last 3 years. And it's just a humbling, phenomenal opportunity for us to be a part of that program and utilize those facilities. But as you mentioned, Earl, the most incredible thing that I noticed about RTC was the mentorship that happens there. Yeah, you know, you're going to get yelled at. Yes, you're going to get held to a standard and the instructor is going to be hard on you, but just the amount of respect and patience that they show the students there and in the learning that goes on is just incredible. And I understand that these days we need operators more than ever, but just the methodology that they use there, it really works. And I remember going there for the first time, Master Guns, Corey Pascavan actually was like, "Hey, you want to go train with the students?" I was like, "Dude, I'm off the couch, man. You know, I've been out of pararescue for like 6-7 years. I'm running a business, but you know, I'd be honored to," right? So like, "All right, sign this paper. It says you won't sue us if you die in the pool." I'm like, "All right, sounds good." So they just had done the Boneyard Evolutions where they're getting smoked out in the parking lot with their pig eggs and lunge walking up this hill and doing caterpillar pushups. And so I hop right in with them on their final week of their pool training at the reconnaissance training and assessment program. And they were doing the deep end cards where you're treading with rifle, passing it around, and then doing a murky water descent to the bottom of that 16.5-foot pool. You're in full combat tops and bottoms. And man, I felt like I was back at PJ Indock again. And then they're having us do underwater swim with tops and bottoms after a 1-minute session of treading water. So you're doing like 30 meters to the other side, another 16.5 feet down, 16.5 feet up. I mean, it was no joke, man. And all of those students were well-equipped, well-trained, and obviously not all of them made it, but I was extremely impressed with the caliber of individual that was in that program. Just can't say enough great things about Marine Recon.
I don't have the metrics. I just have a really strong suspicion that even people that fail to successfully navigate that course, I bet they go on and lead phenomenal careers in the Marine Corps. Because like I said, you know, when I went, hard cut, you're either what we're looking for or not. Theirs, you're going to bring so much knowledge. And the further you get into that pipeline, the more you have. But just the knowledge they have about how to set up a physical training regimen, what nutrition looks like, and then you know the reconnaissance is just really really elite infantry. So all the skills they're learning in that school, even if they don't make it, they go back to the infantry. They're going to be leaders in that environment. So I just think it's such a great program that they're not wasting anybody's time, not wasting the Marine Corps' time, and then not wasting that young Marine's time. Because even if he is unsuccessful, he's going to be of value to the unit that he does end up in.
And at the time, it wasn't called the Basic Reconnaissance Course, right? It
was you just cracked the can on an ancient rivalry. So there's ARS and there's BRC. You know, I'm an ARS guy. ARS is much harder than BRC. BRC, you know, historically barely even made 0321s. They were closer to like a Navy SEAL that couldn't read. But ARS really trained a really high level athlete warrior. And it was just such a stark difference. The Marine Corps had to get rid of ARS.
ARS, how was that course for you? What were some of your highlights, your strengths, your weaknesses?
So ARS, it was kind of like a combination of Buds and Ranger School. It was rough. You know, we started off this huge, huge squad bay, and every day somebody was leaving for failure to meet a standard or just getting hurt. And a lot of guys just wore out because we were just going so hard. If you didn't really stay on top of your nutrition and your hydration, you'd just fall apart. And I really learned, you know, I thought I kind of knew myself, but ARS, I really learned there's something in there deeper. There's a primeval spot, a primordial spot inside your psyche that you can get into and go until you're dead, you know? And I found it when I was there. And it's, and once you kind of find that inside yourself, it's really neat to know that you can push yourself so far. Most people, you get a side stitch, you know, like that's as far as I can run. My legs are jelly. That's as far as I can walk. And I learned that there's another layer to that performance that was the best part for me. You know, there was an astounding training. We patrolled, and they have a famous hill. We call it Loch Ness. It's a gigantic sand dune that we have to walk up. And every physical event, you would go and pray to Loch Ness. And it was funny, man. You know, we knew it was coming. We know that if we're out for a run, or if we're out for a ruck, or if we're going to chow, or the instructor's board, we're going to go hit this sand dune. And, man, guys would quit. We'd get to the base of that thing, and guys would just walk away and be done. Also, if you're going to quit, you know, come up with a plan, because I would see guys quit almost to the top. I'm like, man, you quit, but now you still have to walk up this damn thing to get somewhere where you can actually quit. But it was neat, man. And that's where, you know, nothing has truly ever been as hard for me as surviving ARS, to include the Q course. They had singular events that were novel, but nothing has just really been that challenging to me after, going through that and coming out the other side.
Earl, I got to ask, because you were talking about people quitting, you know, a lot of operators and our students that have got through the pipeline, you know, they'll say things like, oh, you know, I never even thought about quitting. As far as thinking about quitting, well, that's one thing, but considering quitting, that's another thing. When your teammates and maybe your best buddy and everyone around you is falling down and they're quitting, it's impossible not to think about quitting, because the action is happening directly in front of you. Now, whether or not you consider it and get consumed in those thoughts, well, that's something different. Did you ever consider quitting at all? Was that something that ever crossed your mind, or was it victory or death?
I was a victory or death guy. Yes. I mean, I prayed to get hit by a car, maybe walking to the chow hall so I could get a break. Like, man, I wish we could just get T-boned in this bus by a semi and we'd get the day off at least. But no, I never thought about quitting. It's a fascinating psychology. Because, you know, by the time you're at a place where you can quit, you've already invested so much time, so much effort. And I'm trying to figure out why guys do it. And I think it's who, what you hit your post to, you know? So if you're, because you can see a strong student will quit, and somebody you thought was going to nail it, that person will quit. And, you know, maybe they didn't even notice, but they were a leader in the class. And when they quit, two or three other people quit right around them. And I think it's because, for that person, I think the worst thing that can ever happen to you is be a gifted athlete and everything's easy. Because then when you get to these selections, we're gonna make you uncomfortable. And if you've never really had to dig down deep to be successful, those guys seem to be the ones that just quit spontaneously because they've never really been uncomfortable. But the people that they have around them, I think psychologically they're like, hey, this guy's going to get me through the school, instead of themselves getting them through the school. And so when you see one of these strong students quit, they always take a handful of other students with them. And that's my assumption. I've never gotten anybody to really say it, but I think for me, the person that was going to get me through the school was me. And I think a lot of people are getting through the schools or getting through the selections with this guy, with this person.
Earl, there's a lot of wisdom in what you just said, and I want to help unpack that for our listeners out there. Starting with, you know, I know Earl, what year did you go through this selection course, by the way, ARS? What year was that?
Shit, that would have been a winter of 2004. Yeah, because I deployed in 2005.
2004. So did they still call it quitting back then? Because I remember.
No, what do you call it? DOR.
DOR. Yeah. Drop on request, right?
Yeah,
because they wanted to make the term more politically correct, right? And so then people go back and, you know, they tell their girlfriend, oh, you know, I got dropped from the course. When the reality is they quit, they requested to be dropped from the course. And I think it's very important that our listeners understand that when we talk about quitting, That's what we're referring to. Not just stopping an exercise, but actually removing yourself from the course. And I went through PJ selection, which was called Pararescue Indoctrination in 2008. And there must have been 30 or 35 guys that quit on the first day in the pool. And the politically correct term that the Air Force was kind of pushing in was SIE, self-initiated elimination. And it was crazy. These guys, they could never have the humility to say that I quit. They would be like, I SIE'd or I was eliminated or whatever it is. And a lot of them, you know, they would come up with these excuses. And I know you've heard all this, Earl, but for our listeners out there, you know, these guys would come up with these excuses like, you know what? I couldn't do this to my girlfriend. You know, she's pregnant and she's back home right now. And I just don't think it's right for me to do this. And, you know, where the mindset should be is, well, she's pregnant. You need to do this for her. You don't want to quit on your kid. You need to get this done and use that as motivation to drive forward. It's almost like this cancer that can creep up in your head. And as you were saying, the more people that start quitting in front of you, well, what you look at becomes your thoughts. And so when you see a stud or someone that you've put up on a pedestal quit, all of a sudden you think that that's some type of viable option because you've been looking up to them the whole time, which is why officer standards are generally a little bit higher than enlisted standards, because the last thing you want is your class leader quitting and then taking half the class with him. What are your thoughts on all that, brother?
No, I think you're absolutely correct. And that's so special forces selection has a novel approach to that. Everybody's at the same level. So I had 10 years in the Marine Corps. I could kind of pick them out, but there's no rank. There's not even any names. It's just numbers. So when somebody does quit, you have no idea if it was a guy from Ranger Regiment that just quit, or if it was a bolt field specialist that was just trying to get out of a JRTC rotation that just quit. I remember guys quitting in RIP, a ton of people quit. And then ARS, obviously, not very many people quit after like the first month. The first month is kind of like hell weeky, where you're getting thrashed every day and just getting murdered. Special Forces selection, I never really saw anybody quit. And I actually, I was like, you know, they're not failing anybody and nobody's really quitting. I'm like, where does all this attrition come from in this thing? And they're like, they'll get up at like 12 o'clock. I guess I had a buddy that was an instructor out there. And he said between 12 o'clock midnight and 3 or 4 in the morning, he said, I didn't even bother going to sleep when I was running the camp, because that's when everybody shows up to quit. So they all quit in the middle of the night. And they had actually, you know, they talking about the same thing psychologically. Is it worth it to force somebody to quit in public to kind of, so that they have to humiliate them? Because maybe if they had to actually, you know, be humbled by quitting in public, they wouldn't quit. And then he and I both shared the same thing. I was like, no, the guy that quits at 2 a.m. That sneaks out of the back door of this process, that's the guy, you know, when you're down to your last magazine on Hilltop, you know, whatever, that's the guy that's going to quit on you there too. So, you know, our thing is just make it super easy to quit, because anybody that's going to quit, they're saving us time and probably ultimately saving lives. This is a very dangerous job with dangerous men. And if you're just a fraud that's trying to hang out and wear a cool patch, sooner or later we'll find out it's better sooner.
That's powerful, Earl. And after you graduated ARS, where did you end up getting stationed at? What was next for you? Just going through the pipeline, being a combat diver?
So I actually got out of the Marine Corps and reenlisted under the RMAT program, because I was not too sure if they were tricking me or not, because I didn't trust the Marine Corps fully. And I was like, I want to be a recon Marine, and I've been dangled these processes before. So after I graduated ARS, I think I had a year of just schools. So I went to SEER school, jump school, dive school, and then I was given the option to continue 5 or 6 months of further schooling, so like free fall school, sniper school, whatever, or a deployment with 2nd Force Reconnaissance. So I came off of those. I quit the school pipeline because, you know, I didn't come to be a free fall or a diver. I came to be a force recon Marine in combat, you know, so like, why would I turn that down? Went with a reserve platoon out of Hawaii and Reno. I'm trying to think. I'm like, I still have friends there. I just don't remember where we were all from. And then spare loose change from around 2nd Force Reconnaissance, we built a 7th platoon out there and then deployed to Iraq in that 2005, you know, the pre-surge era, if anybody even remembers the surge.
So Earl is the, at the time, was the Marine Combatant Dive School down at NAS Panama City?
Yeah. Yeah. I went to, you know, I went to Panama City to be a diver during spring break. So, you know, my,
me too. Or,
man. So it was pretty neat. Yeah.
Yeah, the Air Force Combatant Dive School is right down there adjacent to the Marine Combatant Dive School. And I just remember hearing about y'all doing this, what, 10K surface swim or something like that, right under the St. Yeah. Andrews Bridge where all the hammerhead sharks are breeding. And I was like, yeah, man, that's the Marine Corps for you right there.
Yeah, so the Marine Corps, anytime they make something, because the Marine Corps is the hardest thing, so they just, whatever anybody else is doing, they add 35%, and then that's the Marine Corps standard. So I guess the German Budweisers or whatever, they have some surface fin that's like, you know, what, 7 or whatever. So we did 10. So we have it. Yeah. 10K surface fin. It's a pass fail event. What, blessed or cursed? I was the fastest, slow kid in my class, you know? So I was, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer on a line with 10 or 15 other guys. I don't remember how long that took us. It took us all day though. We swam 10 clicks, fighting the current, you know, because eventually tide comes in, tides goes out, and, you know, the longer you're in the water, the longer it gets. But I do remember I packed two foot-long Subway sandwiches and put them in my map cases of my LBV, and I remember just sitting there, and I pulled one out, spicy Italian, and I started eating the sandwich, and everybody down the line was like, I smell a sandwich. I think I smell salami. And, you know, everybody had the gel shots and Cliff Bars and
Eating a sandwich in the open water on a 10K like, swim.
And I ate both of them. I just remember being out there forever.
Would you mind telling us a little bit more about your experience at dive school and especially what that was like to be down there in Panama City? Just, I mean, coming from Oklahoma and then going to Hawaii and then all of a sudden you're in Marine Combatant Dive School. I mean, that's a big change. I mean, combat dive is got to be one of the hardest schools in the military.
I don't think it's the hardest school in the military. I think it's the most challenging because most people just aren't that competent in the water.
After combat dive school, where did you go in the pipeline after that?
Also, I went back. We did a train up with my platoon that was coming out of Hawaii, just kind of knocked the rust off. And then we went to Camp Lejeune and did a full workup with the Marine unit that was going in to take over the Al Anbar region of Iraq. That was my, you know, before I'm doing all these schools that are neat and flashy. Physically, I'm a stud, but out of Second Force, we did the what the hell did they call that? But it was a shooter's pro packet where you learn and are qualified in CQB to serve as a force reconnaissance Marine deployed. And that's when I started becoming, you know, a gunfighter instead of a professional military athlete.
And you talked about the surge of Iraq. Would you mind educating our listeners a little bit more on what that was and just so, what that meant?
Yeah, in the early days of Iraq, you know, when first we got there for the invasion, we just crushed them. And we didn't know how that was going to turn out. You know, the Iraqi people originally kind of treated us like, you know, liberators. And then we started to see this insurgency start. But there was a lot of debate on whether it was actually going to be an insurgency. You know, the State Department at the time was for sure that the military was making it up. There was no insurgency. You weren't allowed to say insurgency. We were still trying to fix it because everybody was for sure that if we just killed a couple more of these hardline Baathists that were stirring this up, the country would stabilize. But that 05 era, you know, the whole thing was just burning. Battle of Fallujah happened about 4 or 5 months before I deployed, but Iraq was really just a disaster. And on my deployment, mine was the last deployment with the old boots on the ground number that was, I forget what it was, but it was a small amount. And then into the unit that replaced me, they called it the Surge. And they just flooded Iraq with military units so that there would be no safe haven. There would be no streety corner where you could, you know, hang somebody and light them on fire. We were going to clamp down, establish governance, and then slowly ratchet that back ostensibly into a safe, stable democracy back then, I really believed that we were going to win. I remember my second deployment. I was like, yes, we got it. Iraq is safe. There's not IEDs every 10 feet on the road. And, you know, here we are, you know, people still going back to Iraq, still trying to help that government. And I actually couldn't figure out why it wasn't working until I became a Green Beret and actually got educated on the human terrain. And then now it makes sense to me that Iraq was always doomed to be a quasi-failed state.
Earl, you mentioned how you became a Green Beret. Just listening to the interview earlier, you had mentioned how you outgrew the Marine infantry. Is that the case with being a reconnaissance Marine? Did you feel like you outgrew it, or were you just not getting the fulfillment there? Like, what ended up being that decision to cross over and go green?
So I didn't outgrow being a Force Recon Marine. I barely mastered it. You know, I had just phenomenal peers, and I have even greater leadership that was there. And that's actually who helped me kind of find my way. And I still, you know, remember this conversation. I got an education on, you know, mission and authorities of different branches of the military and different military units. This mentor of mine is like, look, if you want to be a part of and support the most elite infantry on the planet, congratulations, you've got that job. He's like, if you want to be the main effort and do weird work in weird ways, he's like, you should get out and join the Army. They are special operations in SOCOM. They have all those missions. So if you don't want to do things in a Marine Corps uniform, because that's what I was like, why are we always doing it like this? Let me put on some man jammies. I'll ride a moped down and shoot this guy while he's having tea. And they're like, that's not how we do business here. So anyway, it was the way that USASOC fights war that was interesting to me. So that's what led me to get out and pursue that career path, is when I really found out what they were doing and what I wanted to do. And I went to the place that does things that I wanted to do so that everybody could be happy.
So Earl, we have kind of an informal partnership with the Reconnaissance Marine Program and Reconnaissance Training Co. And whenever we post stuff up on our social media, for example, about Recon Marines doing their thing, there's always those one or two guys that'll come on the comments and be like, these guys are not special ops. Now, while we understand that Recon Marines aren't necessarily under the SOCOM umbrella, being Special Operations Command, for our listeners out there, Recon Marines are special operations capable. They're halo jumpers, they're combat divers. A lot of them are JTAC snipers. They are bad, bad dudes. Would you mind explaining to our listeners out there how a Recon Marine isn't necessarily in special ops, but they are special operations capable? How does that work?
I think the word special, it means different. It means different things to different people and especially organizations. So anytime somebody sees a recon unit, they're like, these guys aren't special ops. Like, okay, thanks, bro. But really, to me, all that means, obviously, Force Reconnaissance and the recon battalions, they are an extremely elite unit inside of the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps hates the word special, which has some great benefits institutionally. Telling somebody they're special can really cause problems. It should be avoided at all costs, which may sound neat coming from somebody that is in a unit that literally the first word is special forces. But really, it's just that the Marine Corps doesn't like that word. If you're a special operations command unit, you have a special mission and authorities. And really, the biggest difference is that every recon Marine is always going to go to war, and he's going to have USMC on one name tape, and he's going to have his name on the other, and he's going to have a rank. And that's not necessarily true once you get into SOCOM. And to me, that's the biggest difference. What work we're allowed to do by Congress. So anybody that's being, you know, kind of a douche, that's like, oh, you're not Special Operations Command. I'm like, cool story, bro. So I had a different, I love my time in reconnaissance. The mission they have is important. It's phenomenal. It's rewarding work. But they have a very small mission that they master. And when you get into, say, like special forces, we aren't very good at anything, but we can do everything. And to me, that's the biggest one. Biggest difference is I have done similar work to what a reconnaissance Marine would do as a Green Beret. And then I've also lived out of a five-star hotel and you know, burned through five or six suits, having to wear them every day working out of the embassy. that would be the difference. But anybody that's trying to lord over the terms to label the work or belittle somebody's efforts is always, to me, kind of the desperate plea of attention of a weak mind.
Yeah, no special operator would hop on a comment section and say something like that. It's always the guy that never made it.
Yeah.
Or the guy that quit, who feels like more of a man by ripping people in a comment section.
Mm-hmm. And also, yeah, the last thing I would ever want to do is go into a bar and tell a recon team that they're not special. It would be a bold statement that could come with physical consequences.
And the last thing I'll caveat on that is that, you know, with the mindset of, unless you're under the SOCOM umbrella, you're not special ops. Well, the support guy that works your radios and installs the crypto into your radios and gives you new antennas that has never been to airborne school or has really never fired a weapon, just because he's at a SOCOM unit doesn't mean he's a special operator, right?
Right. So that's why that whole thing, to me, anybody that doesn't understand congressional budgeting and authorities, if that's not why you're bringing up somebody special or not, then I really have no use for your conversation. Like, it's almost a whose t-shirt's cooler type of conversation. That's why I got out of the Marine Corps, is when I figured out what Congress had mandated each of these services to do. And I was like, I want that UW and IW. I'm going to go to a unit that's chartered and directed by Congress to do those things because at that time the Marine Corps was not, the Marine Corps had been chartered by Congress to provide a forward stage expeditionary infantry. And that's what they were doing as best as they could.
And Earl, you mentioned UW. For our listeners out there, that's unconventional warfare, which is the bread and butter of special forces. Nobody else does what special forces do. These guys learn a foreign language as soon as they graduate the Q course. They go deep behind enemy lines and work with partner forces to train them up for special missions and to crush their own oppressive government. There is nobody else out there like the Green Berets. So I got to ask you, Earl, what gave you that ultimate, I guess, motive to cross over from the Marine Corps to Special Forces and do that inter-service transfer? Or did you get out and then?
So I knew I was going to get out. I took terminal leave out of the Marine Corps. I was a civilian for 12 hours. So I got out of the Marine Corps at whatever time, and I couldn't go to MEPS to swear back into the Army until the next day. So I was, I was a civilian all night, wasted most of it sleeping, but, yeah, that was my whole plan was to do that. And it was a pretty easy sell to show up and be like, I want to be a Green Beret. And they're like, yeah, you and everybody else. And I was like, well, I was a Force Recon Marine. I'm a MFF qualified combatant diver, SEER, and I've got two deployments already. And they're like, oh, okay, here, 18X recontract. And I think a year later, I was putting my Green Beret on. So I didn't know the Q course was a year long. I didn't do all my homework like I should have, but I did enough to figure out that it was feasible, and then went right after it.
How did your old teammates from recon feel? Did you kind of feel like judged by them, or like you left them hanging? Did they give you a hard time, or did they support understand?
I took some of them with me. It actually kind of
right on.
It actually kind of, because a lot of guys get out of the Marine Corps because they're mad at the Marine Corps. That wasn't my circumstance. I loved the Marine Corps. Was kind of sad to leave, but I was chasing what made me happy. But I took a few of my peers with me, which at that time we were all team leaders, which was kind of a devastating blow to a reconnaissance unit to lose all your mid-level NCOs suddenly, especially right after a deployment, probably not that helpful. And then some of my junior Marines actually ended up working for me over here as a Special Forces soldier at First Group, even, which would Nick Gard was a younger Marine when I left. And then, we stayed in contact. And as soon as his enlistment was over, he came over and did the same thing I did. Nobody had any real heartburn over it. Probably my commander was pretty upset because he just got his NCO corps gutted overnight. which has still been my experience. Anytime I touch a Marine Corps unit, I'm always recruiting for special forces. And so if I see a guy that's probably the right guy, I always show them that the path to leave the Marine Corps and come here. So I'm actually surprised that every Marine officer doesn't instantly try and fist fight me for poaching their NCOs. Cause I think in 2017, I'd recruited about 68 Marines and had successfully sent them to selection. I don't know what the graduation rate was, but with my time in working with the SORB, I think for recon Marines, the selection rate's like almost 100%. Like really, it's just freak injuries, somebody stepping in a hole or, spraying in their knee or something and not being successful. So the selection rate of recon Marines is it's almost an assured thing that you're going to get selected. So it's not a whole lot of risk for them. But yeah, every time I meet a Marine officer and he doesn't just start throwing stuff at me, I'm always surprised.
So you spent 12 hours as a civilian. And yeah. Then you got an 18 X-ray contract. Did they send you to SOPC, Special Operations Prep Course, for our listeners out there?
What did we call it at the time? They did, because I had a contract as an 18 X-ray. But yeah, I went out to Camp McCall for 2 or 3 weeks prior to going to selection, and they taught us land nav and they taught us how to pace on the trails. You know, I wouldn't say that I learned a whole lot, other than it's almost cheating, because I did land nav in the area where you're going to get tested for selection. So I'd already been out there for like a whole week in the terrain, in the weather, which is the big one. So then, you know, when I'm competing against a guy that came from Germany or Italy and he flew in literally the week prior and we're both getting graded to the same standard, it's pretty unfair. You know, I'm walking around with my compass in my pocket most of the time, because I've been out here already for almost a month.
Did you notice a cultural difference right away between the Marine Corps, or at least the reconnaissance community, and what you were experiencing in Special Forces Prep Course?
Yeah, I did. And RIP, we worked as a team. So guys would quit, but everything was team-based, you know? And ARS was also team-based. And you'd see, it's almost, if your team was good, you had a much higher chance of successfully graduating. And so even if it wasn't an individual event, we kind of worked as a team. You know, even if it was an individual ruck, the teams would hike together, pace together. Selection was not like that. Selection, they have team week at the end, but it's not the same thing. Everything is an individual effort. Everything is on you. So if you get a little down the dumps, or if you forget why you're out there, there's nobody to kind of cling to get you through it. So that was the biggest change for me, was I really truly felt that I was alone and not part of a team for most of the Q course.
Now, do you feel that that's necessary in kind of preparing your mindset for potential solo operations or operating on a 12-man ODA team and just trying to be more independent of an operator?
I don't know, because, you know, then I get to the ODA, you know, and everything is about the ODA. We don't do anything alone, really. So, you know, even though you might be ostensibly sitting alone somewhere, you're not alone. You have team members overwatching you. You have team members on the radio. We don't do anything alone ever. So to me, the Q course is kind of funny that it's this kind of solo act to get across the line. And then that's the last time that ever happens. My first team, that's all of my kids' uncles. They didn't even know, you know, until they started growing. Like, hey, have you noticed? I don't think you're related to any of our aunts and uncles. And I was like, yeah, you're not. We are. Sorry, I never explained that to you. But no, it's not. I think it just gets rid of a certain type of person that's kind of codependent, that needs other people to motivate them. Because, man, the ODAs are just incredibly effective, because nobody has to get told what to do. And if they do have to get told what to do, they already have another job that they don't know about yet off of that team. So I think it just makes every team member a self-starter. When they see a problem, they fix it. And it really does make an ODA a force multiplier in every sense of the word, because everybody's looking for work. Everybody's looking to get after the mission. And the most dangerous thing in the world is an ODA that doesn't have a mission, because then they're going to be doing whatever pops into their head. So I always caution the commanders, if you haven't told that ODA to get after something, it's a ticking time bomb. Make sure that they are gainfully employed and with a purpose and direction, or they're going to come up with their own. But that's my experience. Experience in the Q Corps did not reflect anything of my experience on being on a team.
It makes sense, though. You know, for our listeners out there, when you're going through selection, your job isn't to get the team selected. Your job isn't to get somebody else selected. Your job is to get yourself selected. The team aspect is part of the game. You got to be a great teammate because the peer evaluations are dependent on that. Your overall assessment from the instructors is dependent on that. So I'm not saying that you don't need to be a great teammate and add value and be selfless. However, what I'm saying, and I think what Earl's saying, is that your job is to get selected and prove that you have the maturity to make good decisions on your own and that aren't reliant on other people's motivation. Would that be safe to say, Earl?
Oh, that'd be very safe to say. I still remember when I was trying to figure out what was going on. SGT. I was, everybody wanted me as their nav man or their point man because I was so competent with, you know, walking in a straight line or at least navigating. I remember we were getting lost bad. And I went to the instructor and I was like, hey, I need to understand something. And he was like, what is it? I was like, we're obviously getting lost. I'm having some hard time understanding my role because I feel like I should stop this patrol and explain to him, the student that was getting graded as a team leader, that we're getting lost. And he's like, did you tell him that they were deviating from the route card? And I was like, yeah, I told him that once we stepped off of this route card that it wouldn't be useful. He's like, sometimes you're here to get selected and sometimes you're here to drive the machine so that we can find people that don't belong on teams. So go back and do exactly what you're told by your team leader. And I was like, oh, okay, that's different. Because, you know, my experience as a recon Marine, if I saw something that was wrong and I just let it fail, that would have been on me, you know? And so it was kind of hard for me to sit back and let my team wander aimlessly around in the dark. I didn't withhold information from that student. He just, honestly, he got overcome by events and he just couldn't reason well. And he couldn't listen to good advice. And ultimately he is not a Green Beret. I don't know what happened to him, but that was, for me, I was like, I don't understand what's going on here. Cause obviously we're about to get lost in a swamp all night. But then, you know, he's like, once I realized that we were just out there and we were going to get lost in a swamp and just to have as much fun as I could, you know, got my head up and, you know, other people's suffering has always been kind of a motivation for me. And so we walked around in a swamp all night in circles. And it was funny now, probably not to the kid that didn't make it that night.
It's almost like that video game Kirby, you know, where like you suck somebody up and take their powers and then use it for your own. You know, it's not like a negative mindset towards one of your teammates or anything. For our listeners out there, it's more of, hey, that guy's out and I'm still here. It's a competition. Like, I just leveled up because there's less of us now and we've trimmed some fat and we're down to just more guys that really want to be here.
Which I didn't figure it out now because I was, you know, until much later, I was like, who would ever not want to be a Green Beret? Well, if you're not meant to be here and you get through anyway, because I've seen guys that are, you know, special forces soldiers. And I was like, man, if you'd stayed in the infantry, you'd have been a rock star and you'd have been so much happier. But you're here and you're a bare minimum type guy. Everything's stressful for you. And that's when it really made sense. They're like, hey, it's not that we're better than anybody else. We're better at this type of work than anybody else. So if you don't belong here, not only are you going to detract from the mission, but honestly, you're not gonna have that much fun in your military career because you're always going to be the weak link, and nobody wants to live like that. And I was like, aha, aha. And to understand that it wasn't some kind of negative thing not to get selected. This job requires these attributes. You don't have them. We're not saying you're a bad soldier. You're just not going to be good at this work. And that's the hardest thing to tell somebody that has not made it through selection, because, you know, back to my recon Marine that in training that didn't make it, dude, you're going to be a rock star somewhere else if you can emotionally survive, you know, not making the cut here, which it just seems to be such a devastating blow to people Because, you know, guys can quit and then they'll go, you know, come up with whatever story they want. But to be found wanting for the standards, man, it's just a blow to some people. And I wish I could give that talk. Like, hey, you weren't meant to be here. But as somebody that served 25 years, you do not want to have a job you're not cut out for. I always use the example for, like, you know, we have cyber warfare schools. I can't code. You could probably beat me enough that I can kind of do it. But if I had a job as a cyber warfare specialist, you know, my immediate supervisor is always going to be telling me what a piece of shit I am for failing to, like, keep up with the work or do it at a proper level. And I just need to find a different place to work.
That's well said, Earl. And I kind of bring that back to something you brought up a couple times is stress. And what is your threshold for that? And it's interesting that some of the guys that I went through with PJ selection that were the smartest, most analytical guys just struggled to perform the most under stress. And I see it all the time at our one day courses now. Like, you get these guys that, you know, they're computer programmers that have a college degree and they're super physically fit. They do marathons. And then all of a sudden I tell them to lead the team out and four count flutter kicks. And I flood their mask up a little bit or spray them down with the hose, or they get really fatigued because they've been doing 200 flutter kicks. And all of a sudden they can't even lead with their left foot. They can't stay in cadence. They're counting 15 when everyone else just counted 17. And I'm like, dude, you have you passed calculus 3. How can you not lead with your left foot? You got two jobs here, put out and keep count. And people will just crumble sometimes. What are your thoughts on that, man?
I think the first time I really saw that, you have to have a certain level of intelligence, right, to do CQB. You have to be, like, if you're too low of an IQ, you just can't get CQB, and you're a hazard in the house. You're gonna shoot somebody, or you're gonna end up getting yourself shot. You know, the other side of this coin is after you cross a certain threshold of IQ level, you also can't do CQB. And I think it's so funny that every time I've taught CQB, every time I've attended a CQB course, the bus of people that failed, it's the dumbest and the smartest people in the class are sitting together on the bus because they both can't do it. And I can't figure out why that is. It's just one of those funny things. But yeah, I attended Sephardic, which is an advanced CQB school inside of Special Forces. And I could almost tell if a guy wasn't going to make it because he either breathes with his mouth open or he's got an advanced degree in some kind of whiz bang sciences. And I'm like, you're going to overthink this and you are going to fail. It's not even a hunch. It's almost a law at this point. I'm just like, what a profound thing that you can be. Like, obviously you can be too stupid to master a skill rapidly, but the fact that you can be too smart to master a skill rapidly is something I've never really wrapped my head around.
One of our SOCOM athlete studs last year, I'm not going to say his name. He's a humble dude, and I know he doesn't want me name dropping him on the podcast. He invited me up to watch him graduate in SFQC class 332. So this was three classes ago. And he was an E4 when he went through SFQC and when he went through SFAS. And I noticed that in the beginning of the graduation, before they called all the names and they put on their berets, they gave these leadership medals out. Not an award for our listeners out there. This is a legit medal that you're going to wear on your uniform for the rest of your career. And there's all these lieutenants and captains and E7s up there. And all of a sudden there's my student as an E4. And after the graduation, I'm like, hey man, like, how did you get that leadership medal? And he's like, well, dude, we were in team week at SFAS and we were putting together this apparatus and everyone was so tired and so beat up that nobody had any input and nobody took charge. And he's like, I just took charge and things started falling into place. And I remained as a team leader, not just through SFAS, but the entire Q course. He's like, I was the class leader for the entire class. And I couldn't believe that. Obviously not because I didn't think he was a high caliber human being, but just because on the Air Force side of the house, like, it doesn't matter as an enlisted guy, if you're the best leader, like, the team commander is going to keep their position throughout the pipeline. So I thought that was super interesting about the Special Forces pipeline is that...
That's something I really enjoy about Special Forces is the first thing that we disregard is our rank and billet. So anytime we're out, whoever is the best at whatever we're doing, that's who's in charge. And I think it's super neat. And it's one of the...
It makes a lot of sense.
And it's, we hold our officers to a higher standard, but one of the key things we look for is, are you able to be overall responsible for this mission without necessarily being the conventional leader, being the guy that's like, you know, speaking and pointing. And I think being a Special Forces officer is one of the most challenging things because you have no influence day of. So if you want to lead, you have to lead before you get to the battlefield, because you might not necessarily be the traditional officer, you know, waving his hand over the hill, follow me, because you might not be the guy. And a perfect example is Afghanistan is the Afghanis just have a natural aversion to young officers being in charge. That's not how their society's built. So they kind of gravitate toward the older, you know, heavy bearded NCO. And so he would dominate those meetings, be in charge on the battlefield. And then the officer would step back into his role when the team room doors are closed. And so you have to, like, you know, kind of pull those strings from the other side of the room. And a lot of people aren't built for that. There's a lot of highly competent officers that just aren't built to, you know, be in Special Forces. And that's, you know, the same thing goes for them as anybody else. Like, it's not that you're not a highly capable, you know, officer. You're just not emotionally built to work here. And you'll probably be really frustrated and your team is going to hate you. So don't come. But yeah, it's super neat. I love it about Special Forces that as we flow from job to job and mission to mission, whoever is the face of that team can kind of be a moving target.
How did it feel when you finished the course and found out that you got selected? And what was your MOS?
I always knew I was going to get selected. My plan, because I'm always looking for personal growth, I want to be a medic. I want to be an 18 Delta. For me, the biggest challenge was going from being a super cool force reconnaissance Marine to back into a student status. I intensely disliked it. And then also I found out that, you know, the to be an 18 Delta was like a 2-year process. I decided I'm going to go with my strengths on this one. And I became an 18 Bravo weapons sergeant. So I got selected, became a, you know, volunteered to be a weapons sergeant, and they do their little, because you get to ask for stuff, but in the end, the regiment has needs. But, not that many people asked to be a weapons sergeant, luckily for me. And, went through the Q course, learned to speak Indonesian. So when I went, language was the very first thing. So the hardest part of the Q course for me was the first phase. Because, I knew how to run guns. I knew how to patrol and live under a ruck. But I had never been in an academic setting. So for the first phase of my Q course was going to school every day to learn to speak a foreign language, which, scared the hell out of me. But I'm not the dumbest person the regiment's ever had. So they've taught worse than me to speak a language. But for me, it was traumatic. For them, for those guys, it was just another day at work, I guess.
What unit did you get stationed at after you graduated the Q course?
When you choose your language, you choose your group. I had a Green Beret mentor, and I asked him this very question, you know, like, which group's the best group? Where should I go? And he gave me the best advice that kind of served me was, he said, if you don't think that your group's the best group, you're probably not a very good Green Beret and not who we're looking for. And he said, also let your wife choose which group, because she's the one that's going to have to live there and you're going to be gone all the time. So I let my wife pick the group, and then I volunteered to speak an Asian language so that I could be stationed at First Special Forces Group out here in Joint Base Lewis McChord.
Well, that is not a bad place to get stationed, my man. How did you like kind of getting back out to the West?
I really enjoyed it. I never noticed the winters that were out here that were bad, but we had, you know, if you're an avid outdoorsman like I am, like, man, the Pacific Northwest is awesome. The trails we have, and then in the winter, you know, I got into snowshoeing, which I still do, is great.
Did you go up to Mount Rainier at all?
Yeah. Well, I never went up Mount Rainier, but they have the Wonderland Trail that goes around it, which is a whole hell of a lot of fun. And I love it out here. you know, my wife is over, you know, she got her pick and she's over the winners out here. And I just had this conversation just as I retired. I was like, you know, the winners just weren't that bad out here. I don't know why everybody makes a big deal out of them. And she's like, you have been going to like the Southern Philippines for like 6 weeks every winter. You come into February with a deep tan and, you know, living in some hut on a beach. So you don't know about winter, which was true. Cause these past two winters have been my first full-time winters out here in Washington. And they are kind of long.
When and where was your first deployment as a Green Beret? And would you mind telling us a little bit about it?
So, yeah. So my very first deployment was to the Philippines, counter-narcotics mission. I forget exactly the acronym, but it doesn't matter. But we went and we worked with a whole host of federal agencies out of the Philippines, which the Filipino DEA, the Padilla being the lead on that. And then so we went and did a whole, and that's what's so cool about being a Green Beret. It's not always about being a commando. So we went, did a shooting package, did a CQB package with them, did human rights education, gave a class on a chain of custody, on evidence preservation, and then how to exploit target sites for use in, you know, dismantling these networks. And I did not know that was something we were going to do. Luckily, I got to teach them how to shoot. I did not teach anybody from the Filipino DEA about chain of custody on evidence. Had other people for that, but I was just really kind of humbled and blown away by the type of work that an ODA would be called upon to do. And it was winter. We're in the Southern Philippines, we were near Manila, but living in a kind of a really nice hotel overlooking a volcano that's in a lake, Lake Tal. And I think we spent almost 2 months, maybe, just working with these federal agencies in the Philippines. A couple of Filipino DEA agents that I still, you know, were pen pals and I speak to, and, you know, they're always real quick to reach out to me if they're having some kind of trouble and for advice on like how we solve those problems.
Yeah, that is awesome. There's no better way to bond than training or being in combat or going through the suck together. It's really awesome to hear that you still keep in touch with those guys, and I can definitely relate to that. We're running out of time here, Earl, so if you don't mind, it would be our honor to hear you discuss what happened on August 28th, 2013, when you were in Ghazni province, Afghanistan.
I was on FOB Ghazni. At that time, my team had been kind of stood down from our site, and my sergeant major gave me a choice. He said, you know, you can go home early or you can come work for me at the company headquarters, which nobody really goes to selection to do either of those. You know, it's never anybody's dream to not be deployed, and it's also not anybody's dream to work at the company headquarters. But so I chose to work for him, Sergeant Major Tony Bell. I figured deployed is better than not, and working for him wasn't going to be bad. He was a phenomenal leader. And I honestly, every time I saw him, I always tried to go hover in the background because he always said something profound. So I was like, I'll use this as a chance to kind of glean what I can from this guy. And it's not the, when they make a movie that they're not going to ever make a story of a weapons sergeant on an AOB, because it's a logistic type job. Planning out ammo consumption and making sure it gets on a truck to the right team. That was the predominance of my work. And it's boring. It's not rewarding, but somebody's got to do it. And at the same time, the Taliban was very interested in eliminating the coalition presence out of Ghazni. And so they kind of found out that we were going to be closing Ghazni. So it got selected for one of these spectacular attacks. And I guess from their standpoint, if they were able to successfully destroy the camp, they got a lot of street cred, or what we call WASTA, with the people in the area. And then if the attack failed, they knew we were going to close it anyway. So it's a win-win for them, because they can say that the attack caused us to close it. So probably about 2 or 3 weeks prior to the attack, we start getting indirect fire almost every day. It's one of the whole boiling the frog. If by week three you came to that camp, you're like, hey, this is crazy, but we just kind of got inured to it. And I actually planned my day around the IDF. It always came you know, late in the morning, early afternoon. And my thought was it was just harassment. You know, they're gonna shoot a few rounds onto the camp, and we're gonna have this big stand down, and they're taxing us for 2 hours of our day. I thought that was the big win. But what they were actually doing was mapping out where everybody on the camp took cover, picking out which bunkers were absolutely just filled to the capacity with people, and where all the posturing for the security forces would be on the camp. And they were also correcting their shot card for their artillery to make sure that they could hit what they wanted to on the camp. So, you know, the day of the attack, I was hanging out in the med shed with a buddy of mine, and suddenly we just get rocked. I remember he was trying to put in an IV for a kid that had really bad diarrhea and was kind of dehydrated. And all of a sudden that building just gets shaken, and everything that was on a shelf ends up on the floor. And I thought that we had been hit directly with indirect fire. So, you know, we're climbing around, and he's asking me if I'm okay, and I'm asking him if he's okay. So I step outside to let everybody know that, hey, the med shed just was directly hit, but we're all okay. And I step outside, and there's a thick pall of dust hanging over the entire SF camp. And then later I found it was actually the entire FOB, because an estimate, EOD estimates that between 3,500 to 5,000 pound V-bid had been detonated against the wall of the camp.
How do you think they were able to get it that close to basically touching the camp?
So they picked the only side of the camp that didn't have an anti-tank ditch. They picked a side of the camp where we just couldn't clear back that far, because it touched the actual city of Ghazni. So it wasn't super hard for them to drive off of a road that went through the city and park this. I guess it was a cement truck, except for the ball of the cement mixer was just explosives, and park it right next to the side of the camp. And once it got to the wall, it didn't matter when it detonated. They'd gained that success and that upper hand. And they actually had three other VBID devices of a similar size. One was actually 20,000 pounds. And honestly, they just got unlucky. The 20,000 pounder, the fuel pump went out as it was driving to the camp. And it broke down about a mile from Ghazni. And so we later dismantled it in the weeks after the attack. But a 20,000 pounder, that would have ended the camp. There would be really no fighting back from that. But I think there was three or four attacks across the country, and every time they would analyze it, what went wrong, and kind of tweak it. So I think the attack at Salerno was the one previous to ours. They had dressed up like Americans and didn't fool anybody, the American military, if your patch is not the right patch, or if it's more than an eighth of an inch from where it's supposed to be, somebody's going to come tearing after you. So these guys showed up in mismatched tops and bottoms with tennis shoes on. So nobody was even remotely confused that they were American soldiers. So they didn't get that far into the camp before they were taken under fire. So for Ghazni, they dressed up like Afghan army. And so actually fooled me and the guys that ended up going down there. So we're figuring out we're under attack. We jump in we had a Toyota, a low profile vehicle ostensibly, but it's a Toyota Tacoma. It's up armored, but only to a point where you can't really tell by looking at it. So it doesn't have the thick side glass. The windshield and the rear glass are the only thing that was ballistic. And then it's got side panels. So we jump in that, and head down to near the airfield where this VBID is detonated. And, I see all these Afghan army guys kind of milling about, and I kind of had a thought, where did these guys come from? And, I'm a Green Beret. Perfect. I'm going to go grab these Afghan army guys and put them to work. But as we pulled up, they all looked at us and then took us under fire, instantly hit Matt Horde and, Chief Colbert, who were on a four-wheeler that were, pulling up with us in that truck. And we have a battle drill for that. When guys are under fire, we pull our vehicle in between them and the fire. And I had my truck door kicked open because I was about to step out with my rifle. I had a sniper rifle, and I was going to get up on this wall and kind of get into the fight. So as we pull in to block that small arms fire off of Matt and Chief Colbert, you know, they start shooting my truck up, and I'm trying to steer this gigantic sniper rifle around from the front seat of a Tacoma, which, you know, it's a neat truck, but even an MP5 would be kind of hard to move around in the front seat of a Tacoma.
What rifle were you carrying, Earl?
I had a Mark 20, which is a heavy, accurized version of the SCAR series rifle. So, you know, still a semi-auto gun. But it's a monster of a gun. You know, it is not a little rifle. Perfect rifle for running around Afghanistan, unless the enemy's already closed the distance and you're doing a CQB fight. So that's always my claim to fame. Whenever snipers start talking, everybody wants to talk about all the shots they made in combat, and all mine are at, you know, 10 or 15 meters.
With that rifle.
Yeah.
Unreal.
But anyway, I got my door open, and you know, there was probably 12 or 15 of them in a kind of a semicircle that we pulled into the middle of it, and so they start shooting the truck up, and I stick my rifle out, fire one round, and my rifle jammed. Then that rifle had never jammed before, never jammed after, but it jammed that day. But I think the charging handle hit the door frame. So I think when I put it out, I think the charging handle got hooked up on the door. It's the only thing that makes sense, because literally a SCAR just doesn't jam. But except for this story, it jams, which now we're in deep shit, because I'm the only person that has even a gun out. But, you know, I've been training relentlessly throughout my career. It's been hammered in by the, you know, the SOTG taught me in the Marine Corps, you know, when the rifle goes down, pistol comes out. I did Cephalic and Sephardic, which are two CQB schools for special forces, and that's the same thing. You know, rifle goes down, pistol comes out. I didn't really have any hope that I was going to survive this encounter. So I thought the best thing that I could probably provide was, at least if I closed with the enemy, they could focus on me, and Nate and Drew, who were still in the truck with me, would have at least a few seconds to figure something else out.
At this point, you're ready to make your last stand.
Yeah, because, you know, I was looking at I picked the nearest group of about five or six fighters. You know, the whole series was obviously, you can only fight really one person at a time. So I just instantly closed with the nearest group of fighters, you know, drew my pistol out and just started advancing toward them, engaging them as best I could. It was funny, like the first round I broke. I drew my pistol and I just cracked off around immediately, and I have no idea where it went. And I just remember, like, hey, if I am gonna make a difference in this thing, I have to knuckle down and drive these sights, because it's a little bit of 9mm noise is not gonna rock these guys back on their heels. It's gonna have to be hits. So I got into my sights and started engaging, and I picked a fighter and I fired one round and just dropped him. You know, because I'd never shot anybody with my pistol in combat. And you always hear that, you know, 9mm just doesn't have stopping power. But, you know, I also trained that if somebody has a vest on, you go to the pelvic girdle. So, you know, the first guy sitting there, he's got his rifle up. And I remember firing a few rounds directly down his rifle, which afterwards I hit his rifle twice with my first couple rounds. And then I dropped down to his pelvic girdle and broke around and just dropped him, and came up back on my sights and just started transitioning between the rest of those fighters, and moved to a big water tank as concealment. It was empty, and there's rounds ticking through this water tank, and I'm sitting there, you know, my rifle's jammed, my pistol is mostly empty at this point, and I was like, well, they don't really have a battle drill for this. What do you do? And I had a hand grenade. So I figured if I'll toss that hand grenade out halfway between me and these guys, and at least that'll buy me some time while I get this rifle fixed. So I grab that hand grenade, pitch it out, clear the malfunction on my rifle, putting a, you know, fresh mags in the bolt home about the same time that grenade detonates. The whole time I was working on that rifle, the guy had hit in the hips. He never moved from where I shot him, but he stayed on his rifle. And when I came out to throw that hand grenade, he picked me up with his sights and followed me back in behind that water tank. And so the whole time I'm clearing my rifle, I just remember there's like white plastic from this water tank just kind of sprinkling down like snow all over me. And I could hear the rounds ticking as they went through that water tank. And for, you know, in the right room, I'm always like, really, that's, for me, that's the most impressive part of the story is I threw that hand grenade and 3 to 5 seconds later, I had my rifle back up, which is strong work, even not under stress. But anyway, the grenade, when I threw it, I wasn't aiming for him. I was just kind of looking, but it actually hit the ground and stuck in between his hip and the dirt. So it blew him almost completely in half. You know, I didn't know that everybody had a suicide vest on, but they sure did. So when I threw the hand grenade out there, everybody took off running, which was good because I needed a little bit of time to kind of sort this, tactical situation out and break it off into little pieces. So I got my rifle up and, I'm looking at this guy. First time I ever killed anybody with a hand grenade, and which was pretty impressive, especially since it's like about 10 meters from me. What do I do now? There's rounds hitting the HESCO wall behind me. And I look out to my left, and there's a guy in a sling-supported prone position out on the airfield, just laying him in there. I don't know whether he was excited or just had a bad zero, but he threw a pretty good group on the wall just below and to the rear of my head. I dropped to a knee, held center on the notch of his neck, broke around, and hit his suicide vest, and he ceased to exist. Like, he was just gone, which scared me. I was trying to figure out what happened, and I remember I jumped up and I was looking because I thought maybe a Polish tank. We had Polish armor on the battlefield. I thought maybe they had hit him with the main gun, but as I'm looking around, I'm still the only person out on the airfield. And I realized that I'd checked that block. I'd killed a suicide vest wearing jihadi with my sniper rifle. And, Dear Diary. So now I'm still like out in the open and I'm like, what do I do next? You know what? I didn't know what their plan was. And all these guys kind of pulled back. So I could hear my guys, screaming for a medic, Chief's hit, Drew's hit. So I couldn't go back around the corner to where they were because these insurgents would just come around the corner and be right on top of all the guys that were wounded. So I just decided to go close with them and keep them at least engaged with me. That way they weren't able just to, freely play on the battlefield. So I started going down to where they were at. I got about halfway down this little lane and, a group of them, 3 or 4 of them hang muzzles from behind cover and take me under fire. And so I'm trying to shoot back, I have this super cool sniper rifle, not the best rifle for inside of 15 meters type fighting. But I have a little 45 offset red dot and I'm trying to use that as best I can. And I'm indexing from fighter to fighter. Every time I fire a couple rounds out of them, it kind of bats them down and at least keeps them from being able to take that well-aimed shot at me. And then my rifle runs dry because it's a sniper rifle and doesn't hold that much ammunition. And as soon as my rifle went dry, I dumped the magazine and I super elevated my muzzle so I could start working that reload. But as soon as I broke my muzzle up, the nearest fighter to me stepped from behind cover and threw his AK into his sling and just started sprinting for me and doing the classic, Al Akbar, and running at me. And I figured that wasn't good. Unfortunately for him, I practiced speed reloads more than he practiced sprinting. Cause he got about halfway, to me. I had my gun back up and I just kind of pressed it out in front of me, held turret caps about waist high and just hammered away at him, which detonated his vest.
All these guys had vests on, Oral?
Yeah, that's what I found out later is everybody except for me brought a suicide vest. But, we figured it out as the battle went. So anyway, I detonated his vest. It felt like he was hanging on the end of my rifle. But when we kind of go back and measure it, he was probably at that, 6 to 7 meters distance. The only thing that saved me is as I was reloading and engaging, I kept moving, and I had I pulled in behind a generator junction panel, which caught all the frag when his vest detonated. But the blast still blew me down into this wall. And another fighter left cover, and he was just walking up on me, firing rounds, trying to give me a coup de grace to the head. He wasn't indexing his sights, though. He was just kind of looking over his rifle, holding it in a high chest. And all his rounds were landing, 10 or 12 inches low in front of my face. So I, kind of sat up, pulled my rifle up, and started hammering away at him, and folded him up, got to my feet. And then the fighters to his rear were still, still firing at me from behind cover. I started engaging them with my rifle, and of course I ran out of ammunition again. So this time, instead of reloading there in front of everybody, I dumped the mag and I sprint back down to the water tank. And as I round that water tank, I bump into Drew Busick, who was in the back seat of the truck. And just one of those weird things that happens in combat. A round had come in my door, missed me, but hit the A pillar of my door, ricocheted down into the rear door, and activated the child safety locks in the truck. So when I stepped out with my pistol, Drew tried to follow me and his door wouldn't open. And then as they were firing at me, they were missing me. And then the rounds were going through my seat and then hitting Drew. But anyway, the driver, Nate, did some evasive driving, did a quick little reverse 180, and Drew climbed out the other side of the truck and then has been running up to where I was at. And so we linked back up, and I'm like, I remember seeing him. I'm like, Drew, I know right where they're at. And Drew's sitting there. He's like, well, let's go get them then. And Drew was doing he was on the B team with me, but he was also the intelligence sergeant for my ODA. And he'd been doing some low pro work. For that, he had an MP5 with not that much ammo. But it's,
How was Drew doing at the time? I mean, how many times was he hit?
I don't know. Cause I don't think he noticed a lot of them until after the battle, but lucky for him, every time a round came through, it would hit a piece of the truck. So he didn't get like the traditional in and out bullet wound. He just has these chunks of like the copper jacket of a round or the lead base of a round. So he's got all these, it looked like he'd been in a knife fight more than gunshots because he had all these weird cuts, ruined one of his tattoos, which he's still pretty upset about. But anyway, we link up and he's on the far left of this little lane. I'm on the far right, and we're getting down to the last fighter I had shot. The guy's vest didn't detonate. But as we're walking up to him, he's smoking, and Drew is looking like he's going to walk down and step over this guy. So I yelled at Drew, has like, hey, stay away from the bodies, that everybody's wearing a suicide vest, and which kind of catches him. He's like, he asked me what. I was like, hey, everybody has a suicide vest, don't go near any of them. As I'm kind of talking him through that, the last fighter, his vest went low order. It didn't explode, but it burned, and high explosive burns vigorously would be an understatement. So it's about a 20 or 30 foot blowtorch coming off of this guy, which drives Drew over with me behind this generator panel. And whether they saw us or whether the blowtorch just attracted their attention, all the remaining fighters start hammering away at me and Drew. And they had these huge belts of hand grenades because their original plan was not to get in a fight with us. It was to go to all these bunkers, throw hand grenades in all these bunkers, and then ultimately, run into a bunker and detonate their vest. So to get me and Drew out of the way, they just start pelting us with hand grenades. Even with the video, like Drew and I have watched through the video, like even when you slow it down, it's really hard to tell exactly how many hand grenades are detonating. But based off of like the shock waves and stuff, we figured that like they threw 10 or 15 hand grenades at us, and then I just remember everything being on fire and everything exploding. But and the generator panel behind, it's almost big enough for both of us, but not quite. So we're both, sitting there trying to work through our barricade shooting, but neither one of us has really enough room to hide the whole time. And we're kind of playing whack-a-mole back and forth with these guys. But as we're working through that, I get hit real low in the throat. I feel something like bash into me. And I look down, and in between the admin pouch and this generator panel, there's a hand grenade, which it's not a U.S. hand grenade. It's an enemy hand grenade, and there's no pin on it, which makes it, you know, not useful for me personally. So it's I never trained on getting hand grenades off of my kit, but I don't know if you the old Army Reserve, if you pulled it and it didn't deploy, you were supposed to do this sweeping motion to get the stows undone. And that's, for whatever reason, under stress, I instantly just started doing that. So I instantly just started raking where my reserve pack tray would have been. And I just rake this hand grenade off of me. You know, as I was doing that, I felt something hit me in the back of the knee. As I had been messing with this first grenade, they'd thrown another one, and it hit the wall behind me and then came down and hit me in the back of the leg. And Drew and I were both under a fair amount of stress because we were both trying to kick that thing out of there. And there's all these cables behind this generator panel, and then he and I are both kicking at it. So we're having a hard time getting it out of there. Funny now, it wasn't that funny at the time, but we kicked it out of there, and it detonated on the other side of this panel. And Drew grabbed me and started dragging me back down the wall. He said, "We got to get out of here. They're going to kill us." He's a pretty smart guy, so I figured he knew what he was talking about. So we start easing out from behind the panel, and we get about two or three steps away from it, and we both just get blown down. I don't know if it was a grenade or a vest. You know, we're laying on top of him, and we climb back up and start making our way back down to the wall again. And we get down there, and we come stumbling around this corner. I still remember Mark Colbert, you know, and he was older. He was the warrant off of my team originally, but now he's the company warrant. And he's like, what are you boys doing? And I thought the last time I saw him, he kind of arced out, obviously hit, and kind of hit the ground. So I thought that he was dead. So I was like super excited that not only was he not dead, he was up and walking around. He doesn't like to talk about it, but you know, he got shot right in the butt. So when he was on that four wheeler, I guess when he was trying to swing off of it, he caught a round through his butt cheeks, which apparently hurts really bad. Drew and I are like, "Chief, we know right where they're at. Let's go get them." And he's like, "Okay, let's go." Then we had you can't have a war story without a Navy SEAL. So we had Lieutenant Turnipseed was leading a SEAL platoon that was attached to my company. And he was on the post that day, and he had heard the gunfight and had come running. So he comes running up. He and Drew push off to the left side to go back down this lane. And Chief Colbert stacked up behind me, and I go to reload. And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't want to run out of ammo again." So I start fishing around, and I can't find a magazine. And I look down. I have no magazines in my vest. So I pull the magazine out of my rifle, and it's only got one round in it. Which, you know, there's one in the chamber, so I've got two rounds. I look over and I'm like, "Chief, I can't go first. You're gonna have to take point. I'm out of ammo." And he kind of, gives me this look. He's like, what do you mean?" I was like, "I only got one bullet. You have to take point, and I'll cover you." And he's like, "Thanks." So we step around that corner, and as we're going, I hear another voice. He's like, "Hey, can I come with you guys?" And it's Mike Aulis from the 10th Mountain. And I remember looking at him, and all he had on was his combat top. He had a rifle with one magazine that was probably his, like, you know, walking around the FOB mag. I was like, I don't know. I was like looking at him. I'm like, "Man, I don't know how much help you're going to be." But then I was like, "Well, here I am. I'm stacked up with one bullet. This guy's of more use than I am." So I was like, "Yeah, if you want to, it's rough though." And so he and a Polish lieutenant stacked up with us, and we head back down that lane. We get back down almost to the generator panel. Not that it's like calm and peaceful, but nobody's like shooting or throwing hand grenades at us. The exterior of the camp was still under attack from two different places. So there's still a lot of machine gun fire. RPGs are still being put on the camp, and there's still several machine gun positions out in the city that are firing onto the camp, but nobody's shooting at us at this minute. So it was kind of a little bit of a reprieve. And, you know, Chief Colbert's looking, and there is like, there's body parts everywhere. It's like out of a horror show. There's like arms and legs and spines just all laid about in front of this generator panel. And Chief, he goes, "I think you guys got them all." And, you know, right when he says it, this kid sits up out of one of the, you know, out of a near a pile of bodies and bounce passes two hand grenades at us, which causes everybody to run all over the place. And, you know, later detonates his vest. But I remember, you know, this hand grenade comes, and I don't know why, but I just had this extreme confidence that I was like, I've already been grenaded like crazy, and a lot of them were closer than this thing. I was like, everybody's, I don't know why they ran off. That's too far for that grenade to hurt us. We'll be fine. But I remember thinking, I was like, oh, I don't have iPro on. I better not look at it. So I saw the grenade, and I just kind of turned my face into the wall, and it detonated, and it hurt. You know, I remember it hurting, but I didn't get hit by anything. So the grenade detonated, and I got back up on my rifle.
Goodness,
which is like the stupidest decision. I have no idea why I did that, but I was, I don't know. I was like, oh, no biggie. I've been grenaded before. Not that big a deal. You know, as I'm sitting there, I look up and I see Drew, and he's off in front of me, and his MP5 is just singing, and he's tracking to our rear. I hear AK fire to my rear, and I turn around, and one of the fighters, what ended up being the last fighter, has run all the way around us and is attacking the back of our little group of guys. And, you know, I fire my last couple rounds at him. And whether I hit him or Drew hit him or Mike Aulis hit him, don't know, or maybe he just detonated his vest. Either way, he his vest detonated within a couple feet of Mike Aulis, which blew him from the back of this little alley most of the distance to me. So now my pistol's empty, my rifle's empty, and I actually had as soon as my rifle went empty, I transitioned to my knife. So I had my knife out. And I'm like running around, you know, looking for where I'm going to go next. And then I saw Mike laying over there in the alley. And I was like, well, instead of knife fighting guys with suicide vests, probably a better use of my time will be go over and get Mike off out of here. So I ran over to him, grabbed him and drug him back into this UAV compound and started treating him. And you know, it was bad. And he was, you know, kind of a mess. But we're on a FOB, right? So, like, I can see the hospital from where this battle's taking place. So we get him loaded up. Some of the personnel that are taking cover in the UAV compound had a LTATV. Get Mike loaded up. And they're kind of not being super interested in driving out because the whole battle's happening in front of their gate. So, to inspire the confidence that it was a good idea, you know, I took my rifle and I told him I'd cover him, and I just step out in that alley with an empty rifle and, you know, wave them on past me. So they come out and pull with this all-terrain vehicle and Mike and get to the hospital. So I think he got to the hospital like 120 seconds after he was wounded. But ultimately he, you know, succumbed to his injuries.
Earl. Yeah. It's very few times in my life that, I've been at a loss for words. So humbled by you taking time to share that story, brother.
Yeah, no problem.
Before we get on live Q&A with the SOCOM athlete students, you know, I apologize if you've had this question asked a bunch of times, but what did it feel like when you got told that you were going to be awarded with the Medal of Honor?
So I got told that twice. Well, I got told it more than once. So the first time was by my Sergeant Major, Tony Bell. He's like, hey, just so you know, we're going to be recommend you for the Medal of Honor. And I thought it was kind of an emotional thing, you know, like, hey, we just had this big battle. And, you know, eventually once we get further from the battle, you know, I'll get a lesser award when everybody's kind of not so emotionally invested in everything that happened here. But then, you know, when the president called me, then it was more real. And, I don't think I ever really, I just never thought it was actually going to happen. You know, it's just such a, especially coming from a military family, you know, Medal of Honor recipients my whole life were kind of these demigods. They weren't mortal men. So I never really dealt in reality when people are like, hey, you're going to get the Medal of Honor.
Earl, I'm sorry to interrupt, man, but you are not a mortal man. Anyways, please continue.
On a cold day up here, I'm definitely mortal because I need a pot of coffee and about 1,600 milligrams of ibuprofen to put my pants on. But
oh, well, that's your humility speaking, man. But yeah. No, please continue.
Yeah, man, I just never really thought it would happen. Even the day we're getting dressed and we're going to the White House, I was just kind of going through the actions, and you know, and then you know, I saw the medal and the president was putting it on me. And I think for me, I almost got choked up when I was getting it, is I'm looking out in the crowd of people that I brought with me. And I've got, you know, I got Tony Bell, Mark Colbert, and other mentors of mine, people that I really looked up to, that I just respected, that I hoped one day I could be, you know, a portion of the leader and man that they were. And I look over and they're just so proud of me. I can see that they're proud of me. And I just wish that for anybody to have somebody that you look up to kind of be proud of you, man. That was for me, that was the best thing. Just I brought all these legends of my community with me, and they're just pumped for me. That was really hard for me to rectify in my head. Because I'd give anything to be half the Green Beret that Tony Bell is. And he's just super pumped about being in the room with me. That was a weird feeling.
Earl, my brother, as I said, I'm just at a loss for words, and humbled is an understatement. Thank you so much for taking time to share that story and just inspiring our audience and just sharing what a true warrior is. Are there any last parting phrases or words or just anything that you want to say before we close this episode and transition to live Q&A with the SOCOM Athlete Studs?
Yeah, especially for your community of people, man, it's a ton of work to get into this community, but it is the most rewarding profession, and I'd do it for 1,000 years if they let me. So, you know, stay the course and come be a part of something really special.
Thank you, brother. Again, I really appreciate you being on the podcast, and we're going to go ahead and transition to live Q&A.
Cool.
If you were powerfully impacted by this episode, as I was, reach out to Earl personally. You can find him on Instagram at Earl Plumley Official. Earl joins us again for our next episode on the SOCOM Athlete Podcast with you, our listeners across America. Get your notes ready, because this episode is packed full of wisdom and answers to the questions that you, our listeners, have. Thanks again for tuning in to SOCOM Athletes Podcast Send Me. This is your host, Jason. We are out.